Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. In May 2018, President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal and reimposed economic sanctions. Iran has responded by restarting elements of its nuclear program. President Trump says he will keep up the pressure on Iran until it agrees to a better deal, one that includes missiles and constraints on Iranian activities in the region. Iranians' leaders insist they will not negotiate under duress. As tensions mount, we're considering the likelihood of a possible war. Joining us is Colin Kahl. He's senior fellow at the Freeman Spohley Institute at Stanford University, and he's the former national security advisor to former Vice President Joe Biden. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, TPG, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. 1953, when the CIA overthrew, engineered a coup of Mossadegh, who was the democratically elected head of the Iranian country. We installed the Shah of Iran. 26 years later, the Shah went to get treatment, cancer treatment in Panama after the U.S. kind of engineered him not coming to the U.S. During that time, Ayatollah Khomeini, who was at that point an exile in Paris, returned to Iran. This was the Iranian Revolution, or Islamic Revolution, I believe it was called at the time, in 1979. The revolutionaries, we used to call them students, but they weren't really, seized our diplomats as hostages, which ended up being the defining moment and year of Carter's presidency and a major factor in his being a one-term president. Fast forward, in 2015, President Obama and his envoys were able to join with, it's France, Britain, Germany, Russia, and China to negotiate a historic nuclear arms deal with Iran, a deal in which they agreed to get rid of all of their medium-enriched uranium, to reduce the, you're going to have to correct me if I get this wrong, but their low-enriched uranium by about 98%, to get rid of most of their centrifuges, and to forego having heavy water reactors in exchange for our lifting our sanctions and the rest of the world lifting sanctions. So all good, right, Colin? How are things going now?
Oh, they're great. We're this close. I think what your question raises is that there's a lot of history here. And I think that one of the things that, whether you agree with his policy or not, that Barack Obama recognized at the outset was that we had to move beyond this cycle. A cycle that started with the 1953 coup against Mossadegh. You then had the 1979 revolution. You had the hostage crisis, which lasted more than a year. I was telling the students that my first salient foreign policy memory was as a third grader going to a police station where we walked by the firing range where they had these huge posters at the end, paper targets at the end of the firing range that said, "Put a hole in the Ayatollah," because this was in the middle of the hostage crisis. Then, of course, we supported Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians were killed. We shot down an Iranian airliner toward the end of that war by accident, but hundreds of Iranians were killed. During the invasion and the aftermath of Iraq, the Iranians supported Shia militia and other militants who killed hundreds of Americans with rockets and roadside bombs. So they did they've done bad stuff to us. We've done bad stuff to them. This cycle of animosity, this spiral dynamic has been at the heart of our relations for decades. And Obama believed that we needed to break that cycle and that we needed to break it specifically in the nuclear domain because this was the one area. Look, Iran is a troublesome actor in the region. They're a leading state sponsor of terrorism. They support militants like Hezbollah and Hamas and others. But really, in terms of a threat to the vital interests of the United States, the nuclear issue stands out. And so Obama believed we could use the nuclear issue as a way to break this cycle, and he had inherited an Iranian nuclear program at the end of the George W. Bush administration that was growing rapidly. At the beginning of the Obama administration, Iran was 6 to 9 months away from being able to produce the explosive material for their first nuclear weapon. By the time the Iranian nuclear deal was struck, that breakout timeline was reduced to about 2 months, right? Had Obama not struck the Iran nuclear deal, either he or his successor would have been faced with the awful choice of either accepting an Iranian nuclear weapon or going to war to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. So instead, Obama worked alongside the so-called P5 plus one, the other permanent members of the Security Council that you mentioned, plus Germany, plus the EU, to strike a multilateral deal that rolled back Iran's nuclear program, substantially moved them back, that breakout timeline back to at least a year, put in place the most stringent transparency and verification measures ever negotiated on nuclear issues, and an agreement that was widely embraced by the international community and blessed by the UN Security Council. So this was a multilateral agreement, which I think a lot of Americans don't get. When Trump walked away from an agreement, he didn't walk away from just an Obama deal with Iran. He walked away from an international agreement, which is why there's so little international support for our Iran policy. And one of the things, which I'm sure we'll discuss, that troubles me most about the moment that we're in, I think what Trump did was short-sighted. It was short-sighted because Iran has restarted its nuclear program. It was short-sighted because Iran has become more provocative, not less provocative as a response. But even if one doesn't agree with that assessment, we are now back into a confrontational spiral with Iran without the rest of the world on our side. And that is an extraordinarily dangerous place to be, even for a superpower.
Now, not only have we reimposed sanctions on Iran and put forth an oil embargo, but we also have something called secondary sanctions, which I think are new with this deal, you can tell me. But that's a situation in which we can sanction non-Americans doing business, including Frenchmen, Brits, Germans, et cetera, doing business with Iran. How does that work and how is it affecting folks?
Yeah, so this was really a tool that that the Treasury Department started to use in the George W. Bush administration against rogue states, principally. It was a tool the Obama administration used in the context of Iran as well. We use it with other countries. But essentially we have a primary embargo with Iran that's existed since the revolution. The United States doesn't trade with Iran. The Iran nuclear deal allowed a little bit of trade with like carpets and pistachios and some Boeing aircraft. But by and large, it did nothing to affect the underlying embargo on trade between the United States and Iran. Our banks don't interact with them. Our businesses don't sell them stuff. But Iran interacts with the rest of the world. Iran's banking system is connected with the international banking system. Obviously, Iran, until pretty recently, was selling about 2.5 million barrels of oil every day on the global market. What secondary sanctions do is they basically say to the rest of the world, you have a choice. You can either do business with the United States or you can do business with the targeted country, in this case, Iran. And since Iran's economy is relatively small and the United States economy is the biggest in the world, most banks and most businesses are going to make the choice to stay connected to the United States and our financial system rather than to be disconnected in order to do business with Iran. And so what that allows is for the United States to engage in sanctions unilaterally that nevertheless have international impact. Now, other countries don't like this, right? Because they basically see it as imposing U.S. preferences and using the power of the dollar and the U.S. financial system to impose our foreign policy on the rest of the world. Now, during the Obama administration, that was cushioned by the fact that these sanctions were blessed by the U.N. Security Council, and we were negotiating alongside the rest of the most important countries in the world on a nuclear deal and moving in a general direction that most of the world agreed with. So because of that, people kind of stomached the fact that we were applying secondary sanctions and went along with us, and the European Union had their own oil embargo and other countries, like-minded countries, put in their own sanctions, and there were UN sanctions and everything the rest. What the Trump administration has done is pulled out of unilateral deal, and one that was blessed by the United Nations, and said, we don't care what the rest of the world thinks. We're going to impose our preferences on you regardless. And so what that has done is it's been economically effective. I mean, Iran's economy has been devastated by the reimposition of sanctions. Inflation is skyrocketing. Their economy is in recession. The IMF thinks that they're going to go into even deeper recession. Now, given the choice between doing business with Iran and the United States, companies and banks are voting rationally to continue to do business with the United States. And yet, diplomatically, the irony is Iran is this bad actor in the world, and yet the United States, not Iran, is diplomatically isolated. Us moving away from the Iran deal has created a deep crisis in transatlantic relations, where Europe wakes up every single day and tries to figure out how to circumvent U.S. foreign policy as opposed to work with us on these issues, and it's pushed Iran closer to China and Russia. So again, this goes to my view, which is whatever one thinks of the current policy, I think we could all agree we would be better situated if we were doing it with the rest of the world on our side. And the unfortunate reality is we're not.
And we've now just recently sanctioned a Chinese, a state-owned enterprise
Correct.
For importing oil from Iran.
Which is the first time we've done this to a Chinese entity. And that's because China is, look, the Trump administration's theory of the case on maximum pressure is to drive Iranian oil exports, which are the lifeblood of the Iranian economy, to as close to zero as possible. Mm-hmm. And you can't do that if you don't get Chinese imports of Iranian oil way down. And so before Trump's withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal in May of last year and the reimposition of sanctions, Iran was exporting about 2.5 million barrels a day. But when the Trump administration initiated these sanctions on oil, they basically gave waivers to a bunch of the big Asian oil customers, China and India being at the top of that list. This past May, so May of this year, as opposed to May of 2018 when they withdrew from the deal, they removed those waivers. And so now Iran's oil exports are down to about 300,000 barrels a day from 2.5 million barrels a day. And most of those remaining barrels are going to China, which is why they're going after the Chinese.
Right. Now, you said that it was economically effective to basically crush the Iranian economy. Diplomatically, it was isolating. What about politically within Iran? I know that Secretary Pompeo has said, well, gee, if we destroy the economy, that will enrage the population and they will rise up and overthrow their leaders. Is that the natural human response?
Not historically. There are revolutions that have been produced by deep economic crisis, but not a lot of examples of revolutions produced by deep economic crisis that have been externally produced by some actor. I mean, essentially, to be radically simplistic, you can think about, in Iran, you can think about elite dynamics and popular dynamics. The elite dynamics, a lot of times people draw distinctions between kind of conservatives and hardliners on the one end, people, you know, hawks on national security, religiously pious conservatives, very anti-U.S., and pragmatists and reformists who are not liberals along the Western political spectrum, but do want a more normal relationship with the international community and a more normal relationship with the West, if not necessarily the United States. And what the withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal has done is it's marginalized those moderate voices. Why? Because during the negotiation of the Iran nuclear deal, President Rouhani, who is part of this kind of moderate pragmatic camp, and his foreign minister and chief negotiator on the nuclear deal, Javad Zarif, who you've probably seen on TV, is a very kind of eloquent English speaker, they basically told the Supreme Leader that the Iran nuclear deal is the best deal that we can get to get Iran out from under the sanctions that the Obama administration had worked with the world to impose. And the Supreme Leader said, you guys are crazy. You guys are suckers. The great Satan will stab you in the back. Believe me. He said, I'm willing to let you do this. Right? He played a very savvy political game where he basically said, I'm willing for you guys to do this, but if it fails, it's on you. And meanwhile, a bunch of the more conservative and hardline voices in Iran, especially among the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, the kind of the Praetorian Guard of the revolution, were also saying that Rouhani and Zarif were selling out the nation. Mm-hmm. So what, in terms of elite politics inside Iran, what Trump's withdrawal did was it validated the argument against moderates, right? It basically said, oh yeah, you hardliners, you were right, right? The moderates were suckers. Because the Americans signed up to a deal and then betrayed you, right? So that's how the elite dynamic is playing out. And so Rouhani and Zarif are really very much on their back foot. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out in 2021 when there's a presidential election inside Iran. So that's thing one. That's the elite politics where I think, forces, I think all else being equal, we would prefer to be in ascendance or actually on the defensive inside Iran. In terms of the popular sentiment, I think we all have to be humble that we don't really know what's going on inside Iran. The Iran nuclear deal itself was popular among the Iranian public, but the Iranian public was also frustrated that they actually hadn't received very much economic benefit from the lifting, the suspension of sanctions under the deal. So there were actually protests against the regime prior to Trump's withdrawal from the agreement. The problem is that in withdrawing from the agreement and reimposing sanctions, it now allows the Iranian regime to paint the United States as the reason for economic difficulties as opposed to the regime's mismanagement and corruption or spending too much money propping up Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria or supporting the Houthis in Yemen or whatever else they're doing. And so essentially, my read of Iranian public opinion is that a lot of Iranians are essentially blaming both sides. They blame the regime and the Americans. But that we're not likely to see, you know, John Bolton's dream of an Iranian revolution sparked by maximum pressure anytime soon, because the protests are sporadic, they're diffused, there's no leadership, and the regime in Iran has extraordinarily potent repressive capabilities. Yeah. And I think we should keep in mind, you know, we've had an embargo on Cuba for decades, and it hasn't produced regime change there. We are decimating the Venezuelan economy right now, and Maduro is clinging on. I don't think that the mullahs are going anywhere anytime soon as a consequence of Trump's policy. So the only way the maximum pressure campaign works is if it forces Iran to capitulate, this regime to capitulate, as opposed to this regime to fall, and I don't think that capitulation is likely. Right.
Let's talk about the neighborhood. You mentioned the war in Yemen, which is in large part a proxy war between UAE and Saudi on one side and the Iranians on the other. Israel, way back when we were negotiating in 2015, was advocating taking military action against the nuclear weapons complex rather than going the arms control route. What is the likely response from Netanyahu right now under today's circumstance? But also, what is the likely response from the Saudis in today's circumstance?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, I think a little bit, the Israelis, the Saudis, and the Emiratis are like, you know, that old saying, the dog that caught the car, right? You have the dog that chases after the car, and then what happens if it actually catches it? So they've actually caught, they've got, you know, in the Trump administration, they have an administration that is essentially doing exactly what they hope that American foreign policy was doing. It's not producing the effects, I think, that they would hope. One thing, Jane, I would say about the Israeli position in during the Obama administration on a military strike, because I was at the Pentagon from 2009 till the end of 2011. I took 13 trips to Israel in that time frame. I had over 100 meetings with senior Israeli political and military and defense officials in that time frame. And this was the issue we talked about more than any other. Mm-hmm. And I will say that while the senior political leadership, specifically Prime Minister Netanyahu and his defense minister at the time, Ehud Barak, were supportive of at least the prospect of an Israeli strike if Iran got too close to a nuclear weapon, that was largely opposed by their defense establishment and their intelligence establishment. Mossad thought a strike would be a bad idea. The IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, thought it would be a bad idea, largely because they believed that Israel's capabilities, while potent, could only set the program back a certain period of time, and that if anybody was going to do this, it should be the Americans, who could do a much more effective job, not the Israelis, and that if the Israelis did it against American wishes, it would create a deep crisis in U.S.-Israeli relations, which ultimately would be more threatening to Israel than Iran would be. So fast forward to now. I think right now, as long as Iran is not going full speed ahead on restarting their nuclear program, right now they've dialed it from 3 to 4, not from 3 to 8 or 9 on the rheostat, that the Israelis will basically sit back and essentially let the Trump administration do their thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think the greater danger is if Iran starts to dial their nuclear program out. Because look, why is Iran doing what they're doing? Why has Iran started to blow past the stockpile limit on low-enriched uranium? Why are they starting to enrich at slightly higher levels? Why are they engaging in provocations in the Strait of Hormuz? They're doing all of these things to generate leverage. We're generating leverage against them by imposing sanctions. They're generating leverage against the international community by reactivating their nuclear program and therefore the specter of an Iranian nuclear weapon, and by threatening global oil supplies. This is not to excuse their behavior. I think what the Iranians are doing to threaten freedom of navigation in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz has no excuse, but it is completely explainable and was completely predicted when Trump withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal. So right now, we're putting pressure on them. They're trying to put pressure back on us, the international community. And right now, I think the Israelis and the Saudis and the Emiratis are welcome to kind of sit back and fight Iran to the last American, right? And the question will become, what happens if Iran dials their nuclear program up considerably? And then I think we're going to get back into the situation we were in the first term of the Obama administration, where if Iran gets too close to a nuclear weapon, you will see Israel start to threaten a military strike again, in part because I think they might do it. They did it, obviously, in 1981 against Saddam Hussein when they bombed the Osirak facility in Iraq. They did it in 2007 at the Al-Kabar facility in Syria. I think they would do it in extremis in Iran, too. But even if you believed it was a bluff, it's a bluff designed to get the Americans to do it instead.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think we would get back into that cycle of the Israelis making those types of threats. I just don't think we're there yet.
Yeah. So we've deployed a carrier strike group to the Gulf. And John Bolton, in announcing it, said that we're sending a very clear, unmistakable signal message. What is the message?
Well, first of all, and this is more of a dig, when I oversaw the Middle East office at the Pentagon in the Obama administration, we always had two aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf. So I'm just saying, that weak Obama, who only had two aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf. Look, I think this is part of the problem, which is it's not clear what the objective of the maximum pressure campaign is. If you're sitting in Tehran, you have no idea, okay? And that's because Trump is kind of sui generis. He's unpredictable. He zigs and he zags. He wakes up at 5 a.m. and tweets one thing one day and tweets another thing the other day. And his administration is also populated with officials who have very strong views on Iran, stronger views on Iran than a lot of other issues, and frankly are doing things that could box Trump in on these issues. So if you believe that U.S. policy reflects John Bolton, the hawkish national security advisor who has argued for military action and regime change in Iran for forever, right? Like first Saddam, then Iran, right? And is completely unrepentant about that, and who's, one of his major op-eds in recent years was a 2015 op-ed a couple of months before the Iran nuclear deal that said to stop the Iranian bomb Iran, and who, a couple of months ago put a video on his own Twitter account telling the mullahs in Iran that who were just celebrating the 40th anniversary of the revolution, that they wouldn't have very many anniversaries left. Right? So Bolton is threatening regime change. What Bolton wants with maximum pressure is to implode the regime. Okay? And he would be willing, I think, ultimately to have U.S. military action. And by all the press accounts, I'm not in the room anymore, he was in favor of Trump taking retaliatory action in the face of the downing of the U.S. drone last month. I think Pompeo is pretty close to that position. I think Pompeo wants to satisfy and ingratiate himself to Trump, but on the other end, and says that we're open to negotiations with no preconditions, is that Pompeo has also outlined 12 maximalist conditions for a better agreement with Iran that Iran will never agree to, and is also regularly talks about regime change and that you can't have an agreement with this regime. So if you're in Tehran and you believe that Bolton and Pompeo reflect U.S. policy, you believe that maximum pressure has maximalist objectives that culminate either in a war or regime change. If you believe the president, maybe you think there's a deal, right? A deal. See, I think what Javad Zarif and Rouhani actually had some comments yesterday, too. I think what they are testing is, can they run a kind of Kim Jong-un play on Trump? What do I mean by that? In 2017, Trump was threatening fire and fury, essentially a nuclear war with North Korea, denigrating Kim Jong-un as little rocket man. And now they're in love. Right? I mean, they met in Singapore. They signed that amazing agreement that was 2 pages long and said absolutely nothing. The Iran nuclear deal is 150 some odd pages long and says a lot, right? So I think what Javad Zarif and Rouhani are suggesting is, well, maybe Trump could basically just rebrand the Iran nuclear deal and put kind of a Trump stamp on it. So kind of what he did on NAFTA. Right? You take a deal, he said it was NAFTA was the worst trade deal ever. There were a lot of worse deals ever for Trump. But you basically have NAFTA 2.0 that's exactly like NAFTA with one or two differences. Maybe it's NAFTA 1.8 or NAFTA 0.8. I don't know what it is. But it's slightly different, and he calls it a different name, the U.S., Mexico, Canada, whatever. It has this acronym that is more complicated. And he claims victory. Right. And so I think what Zarif and Rouhani are testing is that the Trump administration policy? Like, is there a face saving way out that Trump really realizes he's being boxed in by his advisors? He really doesn't want a war because, after all, Tucker Carlson told him it was a bad idea. And that there might be this way of having kind of a superficially different agreement that he could claim was better. And we saw this meeting a couple of days ago between Rand Paul, who's I disagree with on a lot of issues, but he's very dovish on Iran. And there's a lot of belief that essentially Trump sent Rand Paul as kind of a back channel to Zarif to explore a possible deal. And my favorite thing coming out of that meeting is Rand Paul said, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could get an agreement in which Iran pledged never to develop nuclear weapons? And only Donald Trump could achieve that type of agreement. Wouldn't that be a terrific agreement? Yes, it would be a terrific agreement, which is why those exact words are in the preamble to Obama's 2015 Iran nuclear deal. And oh, by the way, Iran already agreed not to build nuclear weapons under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. But listen, if it takes that kind of Jedi mind trick to get us out of a war, great, right? But I think the to be more serious for just a moment, and I'll conclude on this, sorry I'm talking so long on this, is that there's a real risk for miscalculation. Because if you're sitting in Iran, you have no idea who to believe, right? Is it Trump on Monday, or is it Trump on Tuesday, or is it Bolton on Wednesday, or Pompeo on Thursday, right? It's really hard to know. And when countries are engaged in a spiral of pressure and provocation between countries that don't talk to each other and have this history of animosity, then the pressure, then the prospect of a spiral is real. And I will give you one example that I lived through. In mid-January of 2016, on the eve of the Iran nuclear deal coming into force, do you remember about a dozen U.S. sailors drifted into Iranian waters in the Persian Gulf and they were nabbed up by the Revolutionary Guard Navy? They were paraded on TV. That hostage crisis lasted 24 hours. Those sailors were returned without a shot fired. Why? Because we had channels of communication to the Iranian government at the highest levels. John Kerry, much lambasted John Kerry by the Trump administration, got on the phone with Zarif 5 or 6 times and said, everything's going sideways if these guys aren't released, and they were released without a shot fired. Raise your hands if you believe that if that exact same incident happened tomorrow, it would end the same way. For those of you listening to the recording, not a single hand is raised, because there are no channels of communication, right? And if we get into a situation in which Americans are captured or Americans are killed, I think the political dynamics for Trump tilt into a direction where a military confrontation becomes much more likely.
Give us the terms that Zarif is coming out with, though. I mean, he is coming out and saying, in essence, you don't have to go back to the deal right away, but we could agree to forever have IAEA inspections of our nuclear facilities if you'll agree to forever not have sanctions on us. What are the chances of that being accepted, and does that speak to the president's real goals?
Yeah. Now I have to get a little bit into the one aspect, the details of the Iran nuclear deal. So under the Iran nuclear deal, there was essentially a probationary period of 8 years. Okay. So for the first 8 years of the deal, they would unwind their nuclear program and apply what's called the additional protocol, which is not only the normal inspections regime that all countries that are parties to the NPT have, but kind of a plus-plus, where the IAEA inspectors, the international inspectors, get greater access to undeclared facilities, not just declared nuclear facilities. And we put in place a process where they could get access to any facility within a certain time frame. And if Iran didn't allow that access, they'd be in violation of the deal. And in exchange for rolling back their program and having this thing called the additional protocol, Iran got the suspension, not the lifting of U.S. and international sanctions. Okay? But at year 8 of the deal, we were supposed to come to a decision whereby Iran would submit the additional protocol to the Majlis, their parliament, for ratification, right? So they're implementing the additional protocol now. They would make that implementation permanent as a matter of Iranian law at year 8 of the agreement in exchange for the U.S. Congress lifting our sanctions as opposed to the executive just suspending them, all right? So what Zarif said is we could take that thing, which was supposed to happen at year 8 of the deal, so 2024, essentially, because the deal when it was negotiated in 2015, but it went into effect at the beginning of 2016. And we can do that now. And that would be something that Trump could claim credit for that wasn't in Obama's deal. We can accelerate that. I think the prospects of that happening are basically zero, because the Trump administration has criticized the additional protocol and the inspections regime as insufficient. So this would require them to say that inspections regime is now sufficient, which would go against their own statements. Maybe Trump doesn't care, but they'd have to go against their own statements that the inspections are not adequate. The other thing is, I don't see the political dynamics in a Republican-dominated Senate as being conducive to even a Republican president being able to get sanctions against Iran lifted. I think the politics of this don't work out. So I wouldn't take Javad Zarif's specific proposal as serious. But I think the fact that he made the proposal is testing the possibility of this kind of NAFTA play or the Kim Jong-un play, right? Where like Trump gets some, you know, TV, made-for-TV event that allows him to claim that he got a better deal than Obama. And Zarif is providing an example of one of those scenarios, but probably not the actual one that would happen. Right.
We've been hearing from Colin Kahl on the recent escalation of tensions between Iran and the United States. After the break, join us for the second half of this conversation. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. It's produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Colin Kahl. He's a senior fellow at the Freeman Spoley Institute at Stanford University, and he's the former national security advisor to presidential candidate Joe Biden. To hear this program or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program.
Now, so the president seems to have three goals. And the first, he says his top goal is to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons. So I think that's why many people are perplexed by his decision to scuttle that deal. But his other goals include going after their missiles, getting some controls over their missile technology and their missiles. And then the third, which is really hard, is to not go for regime change, but go for behavior change. Get them to stop making mischief in the region through proxies like Hezbollah and Shiite militias in Iraq. So as you think about those three, is there a stepwise approach to that? For example, if you did find a way to tweak the current agreement and get a commitment to address missiles, can that be a first step?
Yeah, so first of all, it's not clear to me that Trump has stated that those three things matter, and they're fully fleshed out in those 12 points that Pompeo outlined in May of last year, about a week after Trump withdrew from the agreement. Trump himself in recent weeks has suggested all he really cares about is the nuclear stuff, which is ironic because their core critique of Obama's nuclear deal, besides the nuclear constraints not being long enough and stringent enough, is that it didn't deal with missiles and it didn't deal with Iranian support for terrorism and militancy. And now Trump is basically saying what Obama was saying, which is we should focus on the nuclear issue. So I don't know what Trump really believes on this issue. I can tell you why we didn't fold these issues into the Iran nuclear negotiations. We didn't fold the missile issue in because the Iranians are never going to give up their missile program for conventional reasons. I'm not trying to be their lawyer, but when they're facing long-range strike capabilities from the Israelis and the most advanced air forces in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and their only ability to retaliate against attack is their ballistic missiles, they're never going to give those up. So making the nuclear issue hostage to conventional ballistic missiles struck us as a recipe for having failed negotiations. The reason why we didn't include militancy and terrorism is not because we didn't think those issues were important. We thought they were extraordinarily important, but that folding those issues in actually gives Iran leverage, right? If you're saying we're not only going to have a nuclear negotiation, but we're going to have negotiations over Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Lebanon all at the same time, now Iran can say, all right, well, we'll give you some concessions in a place like Yemen that the Iranians really don't care about. They just want to bleed the Saudis there in exchange for 1,000 more centrifuges. right? So it gave, we were in agreement, our team, our negotiating team led by Wendy Sherman and Secretary Kerry and our European and other P5 plus one counterparts were in agreement that folding those regional issues in would actually result in a worse deal. Mm-hmm. So what we believed was that there needed to be a sequence. You put the Iranian nuclear program in a box for an extended period of time, and then you work with the international community to apply multilateral pressure on Iran's other behavior and try to deal with these crises in that manner. And I will just say, you know, a lot is made about Iran being kind of 10 feet tall or the 800-pound gorilla or whatever, but even by the Trump administration's own estimates, do you know how much they estimate the Iranians spend every year creating all of the chaos in the Middle East? About $2 or $3 billion. Okay, the Trump administration released data last year that said between 2012 and 2018, the Iranians spent a total of $16 billion propping up Bashar al-Assad, supporting Hezbollah, supporting Shia Iraqi militia, supporting the Houthis. It's just not very expensive, right? And the reason that Iran is able to do this on the cheap is that they're not trying to build up states. They're exploiting instability in all of these areas, and it's just not all that hard to do. Do you know how much money the Iranians have spent propping up the Houthis in Yemen? Maybe $100 million. Do you know how much the Saudi coalition has spent on the war? Probably $50 billion with a B. The Iranians will do that forever. All right? So the solution is not to fight Iran by killing everybody in Yemen. The solution is a political settlement in Yemen that creates a power-sharing arrangement. The solution in Iraq is not forcing the Iraqis to choose between us and Iran, because if we force them to choose, they'll choose Iran. Iran lives there. The solution is to play the long game for balancing Iranian influence in a place like Iraq or Lebanon. The problem is these are not sexy answers, right? And they're not chest-thumping answers, but they're probably the only ones that are viable. So that's a long way of saying we need to get the nuclear issue back in a box, and then we need to have a holistic regional strategy that addresses the instability that gives Iran so many avenues. And if we're ever going to get at their ballistic missile problem, and the Iranian regime mentioned this the other day, we probably will have to do it in the context of some regional arms control arrangement. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be really tough, right? Mm-hmm. Even putting aside Israel, which I think would never be part of this arrangement, even if you focused it just on the Gulf, it would require a fundamental recalibration of our relationship with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates at the very least. So I wouldn't want to tie this all into one thing. I think you cover them, you handle them separately because they're complicated enough.
Yeah, and we face this with the Soviet Union when we would negotiate arms control agreements. If we combined it with changes when it came to human rights, we wouldn't have ever gotten the nuclear arms control agreements.
Yeah, or you tied up a nuclear arms agreement to whatever they were doing to support the Sandinistas or Cuba or Angola or, you know, yeah. That's not the way we did it.
So what is this administration? One of the reasons we've been concerned about the Iran nuclear program is not only that they're a great danger to Israel, for example, with nuclear weapons, but also there was always a fear, always a concern that their nuclear program would inspire the Saudis to develop their own. And then the world would become even more dangerous. What is this administration's view of that particular problem?
Yeah, it's odd. On the one hand, I think they agree with the notion that Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon is dangerous because it could potentially set off a cascade of proliferation across the region, with Saudi Arabia being the prime candidate, but other countries like the United Arab Emirates or maybe Turkey or others facing incentives to get the bomb. I will say I'm also a card-carrying political scientist, and the political science literature actually suggests that reactive proliferation like that doesn't actually happen very often. But putting that aside, so on the one hand, I think they agree with the concern that the Saudis might get a bomb. On the other hand, they want to engage in civilian nuclear cooperation with Saudi Arabia without constraints on domestic enrichment in Saudi Arabia, which seems to put Saudi Arabia closer to getting this type of capability. And they largely want to do that to make Westinghouse money, as far as I can tell. And so it's not a coherent approach. I will say, I do think that Saudi Arabia, their leadership feels an existential threat from Iran, and that provides, I think, a big motivation to be able to match Iranian capabilities. I will also say, however, that Saudi Arabia is pretty far away from being able to develop these capabilities indigenously, and it would take them decades to do it, mm-hmm. and that the real concern would not be that they would match Iran's nuclear program with their own nuclear program. That may be a concern, but it's not the near-term concern. I think the nearer-term concern is that they might have some backroom deal with Pakistan to acquire nuclear weapons, or I think more realistically, to acquire an extended deterrent. So suddenly, some Pakistani F-16s that might have nuclear weapons show up at Prince Sultan Air Base, right? And so Saudi Arabia has kind of a nuclear deterrent in the way that NATO countries that don't have nuclear weapons have an American nuclear deterrent because our aircraft with nuclear weapons sit on their runways. I think that's probably a more likely near-term possibility. And by the way, not good. Not good from a global stability standpoint, but that's the more realistic.
Extended deterrence being a commitment that if you are attacked, we will defend you.
Yeah, although I think Pakistan's unlikely to make that formal commitment because Pakistan's top three security challenges are India. And so they probably don't want to distract their nuclear doctrine mm-hmm. from being focused on India to being focused on Iran. But I do think that you could get, it's conceivable that you would get some degree of at least ambiguous extended deterrent whereby Pakistani nuclear weapons would be on Saudi territory as a hedge against Iran. Anyway, I think all of these scenarios are low probability, but when you're talking about, you know, a nuclear arms race in one of the world's most unstable regions, you know, low probability times high magnitude of impact is still something we should care about, which is why we should focus on the nuclear issue and get it in a box, and why it was such foreign policy malpractice to jettison Obama's deal. I mean, even if one thinks that the deal was imperfect, and it was imperfect, because all deals are imperfect, because we live in the real world, the solution was not to blow it up under the false belief that you would snap your fingers and dribble fairy dust over the region and create some magical better deal, but to build on the deal. And the deal put the Iranian nuclear program in a box for a minimum of 10 or 15 years, mm-hmm. which gave us a lot of runway to work with the rest of the international community to extend and improve the deal. But what the Trump administration did is they took a crisis that they anticipated at year 10 or 15 of the deal. Let's get those dates in our heads. That means a crisis they anticipated in the years 2026 or 2031, and they moved that crisis up to 2018 and 2019. That is bananas. It makes absolutely no sense. So I worked for an administration that tried to get crises off our plate, right? Not to add new ones, not to take a crisis that was contained and suddenly put it back on the plate. That is bonkers. And we're in a situation in which our closest allies in the world spend most of their time thinking about how to circumvent U.S. foreign policy on Iran, as opposed to working with us on Iran. And that is also bonkers. You know, we had this British ship seized the other day by the Iranians in the Strait of Hormuz. Then you had the Brits come out and say, we're going to start a maritime task force to help protect shipping in the Gulf. Great. Except they said it's going to be European-led, not with the Americans. Why? Because they don't want to have anything to do with the Trump administration's policy on Iran. That is nuts. We should all want the Europeans to be working with us to protect shipping in the Gulf. It's in our collective self-interest. And yet, because the administration has done the policy that it's done, our closest allies in the world, the Brits, are thinking about doing it without us, as opposed to with us. And that's not where we should be.
So now Boris Johnson, who is close to Trump, has been elected prime minister. And I know he kind of distanced, as foreign minister, he distanced himself from our approach to Iran. What's he now as prime minister? What do you expect his approach to be? And with the, you know, with the Iranians having seized one of their tankers?
Well, look, I mean, look, I'm not an expert on UK politics. My sense, though, is that Boris Johnson is going to be overwhelmingly focused on one thing, which is Brexit.
Yeah.
And that he's probably not going to want to get involved in escalating a crisis that could become a major distraction for the UK, mm-hmm. which means that that he may not, you know, want to go all in on supporting Trump's Iran policy. And especially since that also picks another fight with the rest of Europe at a time where they have to come to some agreement on Brexit. So my sense is that Johnson will probably say more things to placate Trump than we're used to hearing from the Theresa May government mm-hmm. in the UK, but will probably be pretty cautious on the Iran issue. As long as the Iranians and the UK can come to some agreement on the tankers.
Mm-hmm.
I think if another ship gets seized or that problem escalates, then it puts Johnson a bit in a corner. But if the UK and the Iranians can come to some agreement whereby the tanker, the Iranian tanker that the Brits seized off Gibraltar and this tanker that the Iranians just seized in the Strait of Hormuz, there's some swap or some arrangement, then my guess is that Johnson may say more nice things about Trump, but probably won't tilt overwhelmingly in Trump's direction. But the other thing, I don't know much about Johnson other than the other thing is he's mercurial. Like one of the ways he's like Trump is that he's like Trump, right? So maybe he'll do things that none of us predict or none of us would suspect are rational. But I think he's in the near term is going to be pretty reluctant to do anything that distracts him from the Brexit stuff.
Yeah, one of our questioners harkens back to the Blair-Clinton close relationship, which was then became the Blair-George W. Yeah. Bush close relationship, and how much political harm domestically came to Blair because of his support for the Iraq War. Do you see a similar scenario if Johnson is too close to us, and if our brinksmanship leads to something far worse?
I mean, there's a lot of contingencies involved in all of this. I think a lot of it depends on the overall context. In a context in which you have, you know, a hard Brexit and the UK is desperate to have a closer trading relationship with the United States to compensate for the economic hemorrhaging it's going to have from kind of lurching out of the EU, then maybe that puts Johnson in a position where he has to be, you know, follow Trump's lead more on this issue. So that's one scenario in which the UK moves closer to the US camp. Another is that Iran moves rapidly to expand its nuclear program in a way that unravels what's left of the nuclear deal, which means that the Europeans also essentially give up on being able to salvage the deal, in which case that maybe gives the UK a pass to move closer to us. Or if there's a shooting war that breaks out in the Gulf where the Brits have a lot of military assets, yeah, and they have a lot of vested interests, and the Brits usually fight wars alongside us. So that's another circumstance, I think, in which his government might move closer to us. But if we kind of see the muddling through of kind of a low boil crisis like we have now that doesn't tip into a war, to mix my metaphors, then probably you don't get a hard break in the UK position on Iran. But I mean, I just made all that stuff up, so who knows?
So you talked a little bit about the risk of miscalculation. And I'd love to have you put a number to that, what you think the risk is when you've got forces in close proximity, if you have this war of words. But one of our questioners has asked, if there were a war, what would it look like? Here's a country that is, you know, 80 million people. It's very large geography. It's middle class. It's educated. If we thought Iraq was hard, what would Iran look like?
Yeah. So let me. I'll get at both those questions. And for those, as a plug, several weeks ago, I was asked by the Washington Post to write a fictional scenario for how a war between the United States and Iran might emerge. And a lot of this was based on my experience at the Pentagon, where one of my jobs was overseeing the war planning for Iran. Look, I think the biggest danger of miscalculation, beyond the ones we've already talked about, is that the Iranians and Trump and the Trump administration have both boxed themselves in with not a lot of options to escalate safely. I say that so on the Iranian side, you know, they've sabotaged probably sabotaged these six vessels in and around the Strait of Hormuz. Now they've taken this British vessel. They shot down an American drone, but it was a robot. It didn't have people on it, right? So they've kind of pushed the envelope on what they can do that isn't so provocative that it necessitates a response. And remember, even the downing of the drone brought us 10 minutes away from a war. Okay, so we were 10 minutes away. I think the most likely scenario for a U.S.-Iran war is if the Iranians directly, or much more likely indirectly through one of their proxies, actually draws American blood. And the most likely place for that to happen is in Iraq, where we have 5,000 American service members surrounded by tens of thousands of Shia militia, many of which are wholly owned subsidiaries of the IRGC. So I'm talking about groups like Ateb Hezbollah and Asayb al-Haq, groups that were responsible for a lot of deaths of American service members during our occupation of Iraq, but haven't touched us since the ISIS campaign, largely because we in Iran, while not coordinating, were kind of on the same side to defeat ISIS in Iraq. So they basically left us alone. But we're one phone call from Qasem Soleimani to these guys to change that equation. They'll start blowing up diplomatic convoys or rocketing our bases again. And the second we get somebody killed, Trump's going to be a lot more likely to listen to Sean Hannity than Tucker Carlson, because the politics for him change. Remember, his rationale for not retaliating for the drone downing was that no Americans were killed, right? If Americans are killed or captured in Iraq or Syria or somewhere else, or maybe, you know, a fast boat rams into one of our ships in the Persian Gulf and some sailors die, then I think the politics for him change very differently. And as much as I really believe Trump does not want a war, the thing he fears even more is looking weak. So if the Iranians draw blood on purpose, or because one of their proxies takes action without full permission of Tehran, but is blamed by the Americans for doing it, then I think we're off to the races. What would that actually mean? It would not, I mean, in the first instance, mean 150,000 American troops invading Iran. That's not how it would happen. What would likely happen is they would do something, we would retaliate against Iranian, you know, bases inside Iran or Iranian coastal defenses or air defenses, and then they would take the next move. What would that next move be? They might start moving a bunch of their mines out of storage and moving around their coastal defense missiles and moving around their ballistic missiles to take, maybe to take retaliatory action, or maybe just to get them out of the way from follow-on American strikes. The Pentagon looks at that and says, Mr. President, we know where these things are going to be today. We don't know where they're going to be 3 days from now. We got to go after them now. And there's pressure for them to use their stuff before we blow them up, and pressure from us to blow them up before they use their stuff, right? And so you get in that cycle, and you start not seeing one-off attacks against American forces in Iraq and Syria, but massive attacks by militia in those places. You start to see the Houthis dial up their strikes against Saudi critical infrastructure. You start to see the Iranians putting mines into the water, which can take months to clear out of the water in the Strait of Hormuz. You start to see oil prices creeping up, which puts its own pressure on us to cripple Iranian capabilities to threaten shipping. And then at a certain point, there will be arguments made by the Pompeos and Boltons of the world to say, Mr. President, if you have this war, you might as well go after their nuclear program, because otherwise the Iranians are going to accelerate their nuclear program and you're never going to have another chance. So we've got to go after their nuclear program. And once there are a lot of strikes on the Iranian homeland, all bets are off, right? Again, this is not to justify their actions. It's just to be realistic. And if you talk to any analyst in our intelligence community, they will tell you the same thing, that significant strikes against the Iranian homeland are a red line for the Iranians, and they will massively retaliate. And they will do it most likely by telling Hezbollah to unleash tens of thousands of rockets against Israel, because the Iranians draw no distinction between us and Israel. All right? And they, you know, Hezbollah, there was a terrible war in 2006 that cost hundreds of Israelis their lives and thousands of Lebanese civilians their lives. And the war would be much, much worse today, because Hezbollah has amassed probably 150,000 rockets and missiles. Tens of thousands of them can range all of Israel's vital population and commercial centers, which means that if Hezbollah starts that war, the Israelis are going to massively retaliate to cripple those capabilities. And so you're going to see a war in which there are many more Israeli casualties and many, many more Lebanese casualties. And so the war will not be in one place. It will be in every place, in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Israel. And eventually, how it ends, I don't know how it ends. It might never end. These wars, I mean, we're still in Afghanistan. These wars don't end. So even if we don't have an invasion, you're talking about, a significant war that destabilizes an already unstable region that could be devastating for the global economy and cost a lot of people their lives. And at some point, somebody may make the argument, Mr. President, the only way to solve this problem is to end the regime. And that's, so it's only at the end of that scenario where any contemplation of sending hundreds of thousands of Americans in. But if we were to do that, this is a country that is bigger than Iraq and Afghanistan's population combined, with the mountainous topography of Afghanistan and the most capable paramilitary forces on planet Earth. It is not a country on any given day I would like to invade.
Yeah. And the fascinating thing is,
but other than that, it's all going to work out great.
All great. So, Syria.
Was, an easy topic after all.
Was there a point in the beginning of the war in Syria where we could have intervened effectively? I mean, very quickly, there were outside fighters coming in. Very quickly, it was very hard to know how to sort out the combatants on the ground. But was there a moment, was there a time where we could have acted on the concept of responsibility to protect and have intervened effectively?
Well, a lot of it depends on what do you mean by, I'm not trying to be a wise guy, but what does one mean by intervene effectively, and effectively to achieve what objective? And so what type of intervention to achieve what objective? The major challenge that the Obama administration faced in Syria is essentially, I think, a strategic goal that was untenable. And that is, on the one hand, recognizing that Assad had lost all legitimacy in the eyes of his people, and that the civil war, as it emerged and grew, was never going to end as long as Assad was in power. But on the other hand, if you brought down the Assad regime militarily, You risked creating a vacuum, which was not filled by Jeffersonian Democrats, but was filled by Al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra's, Al-Qaeda's affiliate, Jabhat al-Nusra, or the Islamic State. And so the question then was, how do you put enough pressure on the Assad regime to get them to negotiate, but not so much pressure that they crack? And it's really hard to design an intervention strategy that is calibrated in a way to put enough pressure on Assad without crippling the regime. And remember, the Obama administration had just gone through the Libya experience. So it's not just the ghosts of Iraq that are haunting Obama's calculations on Syria, it's Libya. In Libya, you had a clear humanitarian mission, one in which the United States could engage with limited liability because didn't have any troops on the ground. We were largely doing this through the air. We had a bunch of allies in the region among the Europeans. And you know, you could pretty easily get rid of the air defenses that Gaddafi had because of the way that Libyan cities are distributed and the roads are distributed. The military targets could be hit without killing a lot of civilians. It was pretty easy. The campaign dragged on for several months. Gaddafi fell. Everybody cheered, and then it's become a mess. The anarchy that followed Gaddafi, is it better or worse? I think that's open to debate, frankly, right? And so the situation was even more complicated in Syria. So could we have provided arms to the opposition earlier? Maybe. Would it have empowered jihadists who got their hands on those weapons? It could have. Might it have empowered the opposition so much that they toppled the Assad regime and actually brought about a collapse of institutions like we saw in Libya and Iraq, which actually made the humanitarian and strategic situation worse? Coulda. Would we have control over these actors that we were providing weapons to? Not at all, right? And the last thing you want to do is from foreign policy is to completely give over all control for the outcome to some other actor, right? So the most successful foreign policy of the end of the Cold War was the arming of the Mujahideen.
We are still
living with the consequences of blowback from that. Okay, so you could have armed the opposition. Could you have done a no-fly zone? Sure, except that I was in the meetings where the Pentagon and the intelligence community was also saying, well, Mr. President, first, that'll take hundreds of aircraft. And if we're going to take hundreds and hundreds of aircraft focused on a no-fly zone in Syria, you can forget about us being able to do military operations against Iran if it's necessary or do some of this other stuff. So there's huge opportunity costs. Oh, and by the way, it won't actually protect the civilians because they'll just use artillery instead of air defenses. And oh, by the way, to do a no-fly zone, you have to bomb all of Syria because they have the most advanced air defense network in the region. So a decision to do a no-fly zone is a decision to go to war against Assad. And oh, by the way, the lawyers would say, Congress doesn't support this. There's no authorization for the use of military force, and there's no UN mandate. So you want the president to be like, sounds like a great idea, right? Oh, and by the way, if we bomb the heck out of Assad's command and control and his air defense networks and his airfields and everybody else, it could tip the battlefield in a way that the regime collapses, and then you're back in the scenario of a vacuum. So the answer is, all the options put in front of Obama were awful. Do I wish we had done more? Yes, but I also have enormous empathy for the fact that at every single instance, Obama was presented with terrible options. And in every point, he would say, tell me how this ends. And nobody could tell him that it would end in a good place. And when you're president of the United States and president of a country that is sick of endless quagmires in the Middle East, jumping headfirst into another one of these things with no international mandate, no congressional support, the Pentagon thinking it's a bad idea, the intelligence community warning you of all the downside risks. I mean, so it's awful. It's absolutely awful. And maybe we should have tried some things because it turned out so badly. So how could it have been worse? But my experience in the Middle East is it can often be worse. As bad as it is, it can almost always be worse.
On that note, join me in thanking Colin Cole.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Colin Call. He's a senior fellow at the Freeman Spohley Institute at Stanford University, and he's the former national security advisor to former Vice President Joe Biden. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our researcher is Claire McMahon. Our producers are Jared Sport and Ben Berliner. And our executive producer is Laura Beatty. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.